Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, we've got a lot of good things going on.
Yeah, we're kind of all over the place today.
Yeah, now
it's one of those potpourri programs.
Yeah, but we started out last week sort of introducing this Brooklyn Brewery mash.
Yes.
And promised that we were going to bring more specific information and interview the Andrew Gerson, the corporate chef.
And we did.
And we're going to.
And here he is.
Who knew about the Brooklyn Brewery mash? Well, it turns out that On the Menu was one of the many people who didn't until just a few days ago, so we mentioned it in last week's program. But for this week's program, we caught up with Chef Andrew Gerson, who's the corporate chef for Brooklyn Brewery in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome, Andrew.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
And this is the second year in a row you've done this sort of tour, multi-city tour. How come?
So we're back in Pittsburgh for our second annual MASH tour. And the whole idea behind the MASH tour is really celebrating the vibrant culture in every city that we're in. For the last 25 years, or 26 years now, in Brooklyn, we've really been able to support our neighborhood and seen this amazing renaissance with artists, producers, brewers, really changing the dynamic of a neighborhood. And we've seen that occurring all over the country. So this tour is really a chance to celebrate the makers and the artisans and those who are making their city vibrant.
Now, if you want to find out more about the whole series, just go to brooklynbrewerymash.com. In the interest of time, and because the series of events in Pittsburgh started actually just late yesterday, what's on the agenda for this week?
Well, you're in the nick of time. We have a great event this evening. I'm about to head to the kitchen with Justin Severino of Cure, and then another Pittsburgh native, Mike Churikoff, actually from Vinegar Hill House in New York. And we're teaming up for a hell of a dinner. It's called Dinner on the Farm. It sort of, I think, really embodied the idea of collaboration on the MASH Tour. We met Monica Walsh, the creator of Dinner on the Farm, last year when we were in Minnesota, and now she's come on tour with us as a national partner. So one of the great things we get to do is really celebrate and showcase a farm and all of their products at a great dinner.
Now, you're a chef, of course, and I said you must be pioneering cooking with beer, and you said, well, that's not entirely true. What I'm really focused on is making sure that I have the right combination of food and beer to go together. So it's like a beer version of a wine pairing. So that's what's happening at this particular farm dinner?
Yeah, so we'll be doing some great pairings that evening for a more sort of traditional, well, not, I wouldn't call it traditional. We do a dinner called Slow Supper, and that is with Kate Romaine at Thursday, June 26th at 7 p.m. Kate is great. We actually worked with her on a farm dinner last year with Justin and then Keith from Route 174, and Kate and I are putting together a great menu that'll be very farm-focused, but it's actually in a secret location, so you got to go to brooklynbrewerymash.com. Right. Get tickets from that one.
We're supposed to be going to that.
Yeah, we'll
probably the day of, day before. We're trying to keep it interesting.
Well, why not? But there are a series of other events, but the other events being more about just sampling the delicious brews.
Yeah, so, I mean, the tour is food, film, music, books, beer, and comedy all sprinkled in. So there's some great events throughout the week that are showcasing some great local Brooklyn acts, but also some local Pittsburgh acts. We got Steve Hindy, who's the founder of Brooklyn Brewery, on Tuesday, June 24th at 6 p.m. He's hosting an event called Craft Beer Revolution, which is at Church Brewworks. We're working with the guys from Church, Hop Farm, and it's basically a roundtable discussion on the state of craft beer in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, Brooklyn, ha-ha.
So Brooklyn, ha-ha, it's a funny name, and we got Josh Gondelman, Jesse Pop, and Lee Turbosik. That's happening on Tuesday, June 24th at 7 p.m. At the Row House Cinema. Uh-huh. And that's just a chance to hear some great, great local stand-ups. Josh Gondelman is a great act from Brooklyn. He's become a great buddy of ours. He's been in every city we've been in so far this year. Just a stand-up guy, we'll say.
Very fine. Yeah, I'm dying to see that Row House Theater. You know about that.
Yeah.
It's an actual Row House.
Oh, that'll be a very fun event. I'm excited. Yeah. But we have a home brewing event. We have some educational food events that I'm doing throughout the week. I'm doing one at Marty's Market on Monday, June 23rd. That's going to be a really fun event tomorrow. And then we also have our Sound Footage Festival. These guys are also good buddies of ours, Nick and Joe. And they have the largest VHS collection in the entire world. That's happening on Tuesday, June 24th. And these guys put together video montages that are equally as hilarious as Brooklyn Haha. I mean, they... some of the craziest videos you will ever see in your life. Some you wish you hadn't seen, but some you will definitely remember.
Now, Andrew, what is it about Brooklyn Brewery that made it so successful? I mean, it started out from zero. How many years ago? 25 years ago?
26 years ago now. We actually, you know, celebrated our silver anniversary last year with a special release beer. I think it's part of the community. We have grown with our neighborhood, but we've also grown with, I'd say, just the American, but really it's the international palate. I think people are accepting beer as its rightful place at the table these days, or just preferring well-made, whether it's traditional or innovative beers, from so many different craft breweries right now that beer is really having its time.
But Brooklyn's one of the strongest brands that's out there, and I just love it because you make a brown ale, which is one of my favorite beers, and almost nobody else in America makes it. But you also have several other brews. Tell us about them just quickly.
Well, what I think is so interesting, so a brown ale is one of the first beers we made in the first probably 5 or 6 years we were open. And I think it really epitomizes what we stand for. You know, we took a classic style, whether that's the Northern British Brown Ale or the Southern British Brown Ale, we kind of balanced it out and created our own style, which was the American Brown Ale. So I think testament to our beer is really Garrett Oliver, our brewmaster, and his vision for balance. And I think that it works on so many different levels for what we do. It's a balance between malts and hops. None of our beers are overly sweet and malty. We have a real great hop balance. We don't just create bitter beers for bitterness sake, but we also have a really experimental line of beers that to undergo a process called bottle re-fermentation, which is traditional Belgian style, and all of our big bottles are brewed that way. It's similar to method champenoise or the way that champagne is made. And again, it's a traditional Belgian style, but we've been able to really sort of play with that format. We're doing a lot of barrel aging now. We have a series called BQE, Brooklyn Quarterly Experiment, where we release a different beer every quarter. It's really a chance for our brewers and brewmaster to experiment, to play with styles, traditional styles, but also really to innovate. So I think, you know, we are now the eighth, maybe ninth largest craft brewery in the country, and our growth and commitment to quality beer has really allowed us to be more experimental and innovative while maintaining tradition. So I think that's what makes our brewery so strong.
Now, I was going to ask you, there is a rising fascination with hard cider. Do you think that's going to make any inroads in as competition to the craft beer movement?
I mean, the craft beer is a quickly growing segment. It's about 10% right now, or inching towards 10% of the actual beverage market or the beer market in itself. I think well-made ciders are a delicious addition to our beverages. We're actually going to be working on a beer, hopefully, on cider lees.
That's what that I was
going to be finishing it.
That's
so
what
I
wanted to hear
really,
about that because I.
I'd love to try that. I think it's coming sometime next year.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Well, I was hoping that was going to be the answer that you were doing that.
so we won't start making ciders per se, but there are some great breweries that are also branching out. I mean, same thing as mead and all these other sort of more traditional drinks. I welcome all these ciders. I think that a lot of guys are doing barrel-aged ciders now. You're seeing a real growth in barrel-aging programs at a lot of breweries, a lot of work with natural yeasts, or Brettanomyces or Lactobacillus, and just some really interesting beers that are based on traditional styles, but really innovative.
So the only other question I was going to ask you is how do you pick the cities?
So we pick cities that resonate with us, cities that are, you know, we have a great customer base in, but also cities that we feel sort of embody what we're looking for in terms of the art and culture scene, cities that are vibrant and dynamic and that have a lot going on.
Yeah, well, London
also helps
sure
if they
does.
Appreciate our beer.
Well, we'll see you around our city, which is vibrant. But you already know that because you've been here before.
Pittsburgh's great. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia, and I got to say, I never spent much time in Pittsburgh. But being able to work with Justin and Keith and Kate, meeting great photographers like Adam Milron, who are doing so much for the food scene there, the gals at Slow Food, the brewers that we met you know, at Hop Farm and all the breweries. There's just such a tremendous scene happening there right now. I think there's just a return to the way people should be eating.
Yep.
You know, if you see what the guys are doing over at, what Richard's doing over at Meat and Potatoes, Butcher in the Rye, 909. I mean, there's some really good restaurants in Pittsburgh these days.
I know.
Well, we're going to see you around during the week, and we're glad to bring this news to your listeners for today, and more information and get your tickets through www.brooklynbrewerymash.com. Be there or be square, as they say.
Yeah. And
absolutely. Well, we will see you guys hopefully on the farm, and if not, at some other great events this week.
Yeah.
And again, that's brooklynbrewerymash.com.
Andrew, if you get bored, give us a call. Keep our phone number there.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Enjoy the afternoon.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to be talking next to somebody who's been, you know, really a nice, nice friend for a long time, and a great chef, of course, is Gail Gand, who, of course, is probably mostly known for her elegant desserts, but she's taken on a whole new issue, and her new book she's going to talk to us about is called Lunch. I read where everybody was a little surprised at your last book, Gail Gand, which was Brunch, because you're always perceived as a pastry chef, which you are. And you said you were wondering yourself if you were going to be allowed out of the cake box. Well, you stepped out even further with your latest book, which is called Lunch. You call it the stepchild of meals.
I do. I think that it's the neglected stepchild of all the three meal periods. You know, lunch really doesn't get the attention not only it deserves, but that, you know, it should have, because it is a really important meal. Midday, I think in Europe, they take a couple hours off and focus on lunch. But here, we just kind of shove a few prepackaged things into a bag and think that's going to sustain us to do our best work, to do our most important work. And I think dinner maybe gets a little too much attention and lunch is a little neglected. So I think lunch is the new dinner.
Well, that's what you say. I mean, I don't know, and people's lifestyles probably contribute to this, the sad status of lunch. People who are working, but your book says absolutely the opposite. It's not extra work. It's not hard to do. And I wish I had this book when I was packing lunches.
When you were packing. I'm packing lunches right now. I have 2 third graders, so I'm packing lunches for them every day. But it's not just that. You know, people's work schedules are different now than they were. People are telecommuting. They're working from home. They're job sharing. They're unemployed. My family are all musicians, so we all work at night. And I'm a chef, so I work more in the evening than I do during the day. So if I want to have a lunch get-together with my dad or my brother and sister-in-law, it's a daytime thing. It's a lunch thing. And that's what sort of taught me of what a great time of day that is to get together over food. But also there is this sort of lack of attention to packed lunches.
Yeah, when we have house guests, that's the other thing. I never know what to do for lunch. I mean, I can cover breakfast. I can cover dinner. But what do you do at that critical moment? Well, your
right, and there's so many fun things you can do. You know, you can go on a picnic, but I also, in the book, show you how to, you know, possibly make things for dinner or make a sauce that you might use the next day to toss with some pasta and chicken and edamame to pack in your lunch, but it might be a sauce you use the night before, you know, for shrimp or whatever. So some of it is kind of preparation and carrying over.
Yeah.
Some of it is just quick ideas in order to either make something into a packed lunch, make it into a party, make it into a lunch at home. And there's all those different places people have lunch.
That's the section on which I love with every recipe. But before I get into that, this photograph is wonderful. You with your family, your husband.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's so funny. My husband's kind of shy, and he thought if he wore sunglasses, they wouldn't print it. And instead, they printed it, and people are like, ooh, you have this suave husband who's like, you know, man of mystery in Sunday.
Well, you all look so happy.
Yeah, but there's Gio, all grown up at 17. He's like
it's hard to believe
now, and he looks like a Greek god.
Pretty twin daughters,
smile
too.
And shiny, and then the twins are delightful little girls in third grade.
Well, you look happy.
That's the family I cook for.
Yeah, well, back to this, your recipes. I thought that was really brilliant that each single recipe has a little section to the side saying pack it to go with, and then you have a suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
Eat it at home with, and a suggestion. Make it a party, and then you tell how to do that. And that's all
right,
in addition to
the recipe.
Those
are all the different times or you know, occasions you might be doing lunch, but some people are like, what do I put this with? And so I already do that work for you, so you don't have to think about that.
What I was looking at was your pea and garlic dip, which sounds wonderful.
I love the pea and garlic dip. We sometimes call it pea hummus. So it's you make it just like how you make hummus with chickpeas, but you use green peas instead. So it's green peas, olive oil, salt and pepper, fresh garlic,
fresh
some mint leaves if you've got them, if you want to. And you just grind it in the food processor. It's the most delicious dip.
Well, we're going to
make
that.
You can not only dip vegetables or the cumin pita chips that I have you make in the book, but it's great like smeared on a sandwich as a condiment instead of mayo perhaps or, I don't know, you know, chutney that people put on sandwiches. And it stays green for days, as opposed to guacamole, which
goes
brown on top and then you have to decide if anyone's watching as you scrape off that brown and eat that.
Yeah, I mean the pea.
Pea dip just really stays bright green, so it's beautiful on a buffet.
But can you freeze it?
Nice and fresh. And I use frozen peas, so it's very affordable. It's an inexpensive, easy thing to make.
But can you
great for a party?
Can you freeze the dip itself?
Do it again.
Can you freeze the pea and garlic dip itself?
You can. You can freeze it. I'm not sure, you know, if you needed to make it in advance. It's going to last in the fridge 2, 3, 4 days.
Well, see, I mean, I was thinking of the fresh mint because, you know, I make pesto and freeze it because not all the herbs are available throughout the year.
Right, right. So if you make it in a season when, you know, your mint has taken over your life.
It happens.
It does.
And freeze it. It's going to happen. I'm in fear of it happening always. But
always.
I know it will happen by the end of the
season. Yeah, and puts mint in pesto as well.
Ooh, that sounds good. That sounds fun.
And you make pesto. You have a pesto recipe.
I do pesto. I've also done pesto with cilantro, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I use different herbs with different nuts making pesto.
Me too. I actually use walnuts often in my pesto because pine nuts can be expensive. They can be hard
to find. I said to Peter, no, don't buy any Chinese pine nuts, which are cheaper. And I looked at this package of pine nuts, and it was over $40.
They're really expensive.
Oh my God!
I know when my mother-in-law comes to visit, she always buys them and uses a little, and then she freezes the rest.
Yeah, I keep on in the
freezer. I usually have them in my freezer left over from Vita. You've heard me talk about my mother-in-law Vita,
right.
And she has a recipe in the book that the Piki Paku pasta. It's room temperature pasta with just chopped garlic, tomatoes, but little tomatoes, mozzarella, fresh mozzarella balls, olive oil, salt, and pepper, and you just let that marinate a little bit while you're cooking off your pasta, and then you toss it at the last minute. That is the most delicious fresh tomato garlic dish I've had. I love it. So it's simple stuff like that.
With the cilantro pesto, I use pistachio nuts. It really is nice.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I don't think I've tried that.
And you make sage with something.
Sage with cashews.
And, oh, fun.
Yeah, and arugula with pecans.
And then what are you tossing the pesto
with?
Well,
I mean, the rest of it's all the same as ordinary pesto.
So like a pasta,
garlic.
Or you're putting it in mashed potatoes or whatever.
Well, no.
We just sometimes eat it just out of the container.
You're like smearing it on bread or something, or your finger.
Other times you put it on crackers. I like it.
I want to party with you. You sound fun.
I like it on green beans. Put it on green beans and it melts.
You know, we used to put it on baby artichokes, like sautéed baby artichokes.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good, too.
That's good, too.
Really good.
Let's talk about your grilled cheese sandwich, which I didn't realize. We did interview somebody who wrote a whole book on called Melted.
Yeah, Shane.
You know, I thought, we've got to have a sandwich chapter. It's a lunch book, and, you know, I should put some of the fundamentals, like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and a grilled and a chicken salad. And those recipes, which seem so, everyone knows how to do this, egg salad, turned out to be the longest, most complicated recipes. And that grilled cheese, like once you start thinking of other, you know, ooh, I could put dates on
right.
it. Ooh, I could do, you know, slivered almonds and tomato. Like I just kept thinking of ideas, different breads, different cheeses, different additions. I could not stop. And then I thought this could be a whole book.
Now,
it could be a whole book.
If you were really wealthy, you could put pine nuts on there.
You're right. I can suggest anything. And then put dollar signs next to it,
there
right?
You go. There you go. This is a $42 sandwich.
The expensive grilled cheese.
Your idea, I love this idea, is when you have, and it must be, your play dates must be really exciting. You make those wonderful grilled cheese sandwiches, but you always put on, you send a note home with the recipe. What do you do?
Well, yeah, because I get, the mothers will call me and they'll say, you know, Allison used to eat my grilled cheese, but she won't anymore now that she's been at a play date at your house. What is it you're doing? So the mothers ask for these recipes, like whatever I make with their kids, or if we make crepes or we make, you know, chocolate chip cookies, they want to know the recipe because their kids now are converted to whatever it is that I make, and they want to make that one at home, which to me is terrific because that means I'm, you know, I'm inspiring people to get into the kitchen and cook together.
Now, do your twins auction off their food?
No. You're not at school, you mean? You're not allowed to.
You're not allowed to.
There's no sharing at school.
But
that doesn't mean
you don't.
Yeah, no, it's very explicit, and there's, like, culinary cops walking
the
cafeteria to make sure. Because of all the allergies, they can't risk.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Any, you know, if Ruby eats Nutella every day of the week, and if she were to give a bite to some kid with a nut allergy, I think the school has a liability issue on their hands, so they're very careful.
Yeah, I don't know. Are you allowed to send nuts in a lunch?
You are. In our school, you are. They have actually a nut-free table where they have the children eat who are allergic to nuts so that there isn't cross-contamination because there's all different levels of allergic. You know, there's like gravely allergic, there's highly sensitive, there's...
I know a parent who carries one of those EpiPens.
I keep one in my house and none of my kids are allergic to anything. But if I had a play date over, you know, and somehow they had some kind of reaction. We had one of my best friends who lived behind us had twin girls 2 weeks before I had my twin girls. And it turned out that one of her twins, so this is interesting, they're fraternal, but one of the twins was allergic to chickpeas, sesame seeds, pistachios.
Good grief.
And they were Indian.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
So chickpeas is like everyday staple.
How are you going to
do
that?
So because she would come over, and I'm Jewish, so I have like sesame bagels all the time. So who knows if like one sesame seed is like in the crevice of the, you know, stove or something. It could be.
Oh, geez.
So I keep an EpiPen in my fridge all the time.
Well, an EpiPen, that's what you take? That's what you take?
It's like the ultimate Benadryl dose. Yeah, if they start to have a throat closure, you just pull out your EpiPen in the shot, and then it buys you some time to get them.
Yeah,
the
you still have to
room.
Take them to the emergency room.
You showed me. You showed me this rustic ratatouille tart.
I love this, yeah.
Oh, I love that too, and the fried egg.
Yeah.
I love that.
But how long does it really take to make that? I mean, that looks like a lot of work.
Well, you know, you can do store bought crust if you've got a fear of frying, we call it, a fear of making your own pie crust.
Yeah.
You know, I always have balls of pie dough in the house because I'm making pies all the time.
Yeah.
But go ahead and buy store-bought, and then you're chopping your vegetables, you're throwing them in the oven to roast them to give them a head start, and then you're sort of layering it all, folding that rustic edge over, you know, a little bit, and then popping it back in the oven.
No, this is not just an interesting cookbook with beautiful dishes by an extraordinarily talented and inventive person. It's also a tremendous resource guide. I mean, who knew how to make the perfect hard-boiled egg?
I know. Well, I thought if I'm going to tell them how to make egg salad, first I have to tell them how to make a hard-boiled egg, which a lot of people overcook hard-boiled eggs.
Yeah, that's the trick. Now, the trick that I never really quite understood was this. Everybody now is doing them the Julia Child way, which is...
Right. Well, if you look at my brunch book, it has the Julia Child way,
right,
which is a 5-minute. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing that over the last 3 years, I thought, you know, it's a little under still for me. So
right,
now
right.
I do a 6 minute.
Right. I read that, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, for 5 minutes is almost a soft boiled egg.
Well, it's hard. If you're making an egg salad where you're mashing that yolk, it almost turns into like a coating or a mayonnaise. It doesn't keep its shape at all.
Yeah, it wouldn't be
so
very,
that's why
wouldn't
I went
be very nice.
Minutes.
I don't
but
think.
I'll tell you, I was talking to Natalie Dupree last week. She's writing an article for Easter on eggs. And she said, any tips for hard boiled eggs? And I sent her that. And she's like, really? 6 minutes? And I said, "Why? What do you know? What do you do?" And she's like, 11.
Yeah, we do. We do. We do anywhere from 10 to 12. I didn't.
That was my and then you're going to get that green, you know, that khaki green, that delightful khaki green color. On the yolk.
I didn't even realize that you could overcook hard boiled eggs.
Oh, sure.
Right.
So,
well, that's why they start to discolor.
I'll show you what a dumb shit I am.
No,
I can't get it all right.
No, you just need to buy my book, and you've got it right there. So
well, now
good.
You don't. Now we gave the secret away.
Can I ask you? While I have you here, could you tell us about your involvement with Michelle Obama's program?
Sure, and that's kind of how the idea of lunch happened. You know, I had done a brunch book, which was kind of, you know, poo-pooing the daunting dinner party and saying, hey, it's much easier to entertain midday during brunch. It's more family-friendly, it's cheaper, it's not as long a party, people don't drink as much, they don't stay as late, you don't have to hire a sitter for your kids, it's like the perfect thing. And then I got a call to action from the White House, from Michelle Obama, asking, and it was across the country, she was asking chefs to mentor schools in America to try to improve school lunch. So she started an organization called Chefs Move to Schools, and the initiative was kicked off at the White House, which most of the chefs were invited to, and I was there, where she spoke to us about how she wants to have inspire us to get into schools across America and improve the food, improve the nutrition, not only in the cafeterias, but also in the classroom. She wanted us to use the classroom as a way, use food as a way to teach in the classroom. So I started to mentor Deerfield High School, which was where my son was starting as a freshman, and I thought, I can, you know, do the First Lady's work and spy on my son all at the same time. So I mentored Deerfield High School. I got into the French classroom and taught French through recipes through food. I got into the physics class and taught physics classes by showing the kids what happens to protein as you try to get air molecules to hook on, which is meringue. You might recognize that as being meringue. We made chocolate mousse, but it's all physics and chemistry pastry. I got into the cafeteria and got the lunch lady to turn off the fryers on a couple Fridays. I got into the PTO meeting and taught parents how to make easier to, you know, build good, better nutritional lunches for their kids. So it was kind of like a multi-pronged approach to get, you know, better food to these children.
It sounded just wonderful.
That's how it started. And then I started to entertain doing lunches at my house with my musician family who work at night but are available during the day. So I started having them over for lunches and realized this is great. Like, you can have one glass of chilled rosé in the middle of the day, you know, with that the piki paku pasta from my mother-in-law Vita, a nice salad, a light dessert. And then you're ready to, you know, go on with the rest of your day.
But you're also competing with yourself to an extent, because we shouldn't let you go without having you tell us just a little bit about your newest restaurant venture.
Which is dinner only.
Which
and
is
called, ironically,
oh, I see.
Serve lunch.
Oh, okay. So you
yes, I have a new restaurant. I opened it on Valentine's Day this year. So it's just been open a while. It's called Spritz Burger. And what we do is craft sodas that we spritz at the table. So we bring you like a lemon lavender syrup, a siphon of soda water, and we spritz it at the table to build that craft soda right there, or a cocktail, craft cocktails as well, and then we serve burgers. We also have a non-burger section on the menu. We do grass-fed beef burgers, and then we have a non-beef burger section that has like a turkey burger, a couple vegetarians, and then we also have a non-burger section on the menu. But it's called Spritz Burger.
And it's in Chicago.
And I partnered with the Hardy Boys, who they also had a show on the Food Network. They were the winners of Next Food Network Star Season 1. Uh-huh. And they're local caterers in Chicago, as well as restaurateurs, and we're close friends. Our kids are the same age. So we socialize together a lot. We also travel for food and wine festivals together and are great friends. And we thought, let's ruin our friendship and go into business together and start a restaurant. Yeah. So we did. We didn't ruin the friendship, but we started the restaurant. And it's a huge hit. There are lines every night.
Oh, wow.
It's a little urban, no reservations, neighborhood place. Very different than my fancy pants restaurant, True, that I started 15 years ago. So it's kind of in contrast to that. You know, this is a kind of a spontaneous little neighborhood place where kids are allowed and, you know, parents can have a cocktail, but kids can have a great fried chicken drumstick for their dinner. Whereas True was, you know, rare air,
four hours
and special occasion. The main comparison I say is a regular at my fancy pants restaurant, True, is someone we see once a year. A regular at Spritzburger is someone we see once a week.
Right.
So that's, you know, sort of the difference.
Well, it sounds to me like you're like a good friend, Mario Batali, who, when we asked him how he got to do so many things in the day, he said, sleep is overrated.
Sleep is cheap, is what we say.
I have a feeling you're a little bit like that. But here's another wonderful contribution to society at large and lunch cookers in general. And, Gail, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Thank you
so much
for having me on. You know, I love my work, and I love to feed people, and I'm so lucky I get to do both of those at the same time.
Great.
Well, let me know when you want to go to the Warhol.
I will. Okay. I will. We'll get there eventually. If I can get my son to sign up for college. He has to pick a college before I can do anything else.
One more note, just repeat. Gail Gand's lunch. There we have it, Gail Gand. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Delightful speaking with you.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest is a truly brilliant food writer and a coaxer out of great flavors, and she's turned her attention to her heritage, Greek heritage, right, with Smashing Plates, which is a double entendre that she'll explain, Greek flavors redefined and made quite exciting, I have to say.
And by the way, she's a chef too, so she's going to be telling you a little bit about a new dining venture that she has on these shores in Lake Tahoe on the border of Nevada and California, where she's cooking modern Greek, just exactly what you'd expect. So a really remarkable lady, and don't be fooled. I guess not all of the members of her family are Greek. Some of them are actually English.
You know, the name Maria Elia sounded familiar, but I didn't remember until we talked today, Maria, that we have indeed talked to you before. And we talked about your vegetarian cookbook last year, right?
That's right. And I also think we talked about Full of Flavor.
Full of Flavor, which in the recipes were. And this book, your new book, is full of flavor, too. And in fact, it's called Smashing Plates, which is, of course, a title I adore because it's perfect for the tradition of doing that. And then the essence of your book is, in fact, reinventing traditional Greek flavors into a modern sensibility. So I think it's a brilliant title. Did you think of that?
We did. I did. I was saying to my friends, and I was saying to them, upbringing, every Sunday my dad would drag my sister, mum, and I to another Greek wedding. And so the only thing I enjoyed about it was all the food at the table and smashing plates. And she said, that's what you should call your book. But in England, we often describe things as smashing, meaning that they're great or they're good. That'd be a great title. But then I was like, oh no, maybe that sounds really egotistic if I call my own book Smashing Plates.
From
an English point of view, it has two meanings.
Right, well, you have 120 recipes in this book, and the recipes themselves are totally delicious, and your anecdotes or the notes, personal notes, accompanying each recipe makes it a very personalized book. You are in love with this book in a way, aren't you?
I am. probably the most personal book that I wrote. My publisher was always going at me about, hey, what did you write about your Greek heritage for like past 5 years? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And I was going to write another vegetarian book. And it was while I was at work one day, I was in a restaurant where I could, there wasn't a defined cuisine. And I got some Greek ingredients in. And it was literally that kind of eureka moment. I tasted some Greek ingredients, played around with them, and just went, oh my God, these ingredients really, really, really do touch my soul. And people are like, that's really dramatic. It's like, no, food's really emotive, you know. And it suddenly took me back to my childhood and going to my aunties and being in the restaurant with my dad and tasting all this Greek food. And I was like, this is it. I got really excited. This is the area that I should concentrate on. So I met my publisher for lunch. We went to go through the synopsis for the vegetarian book. And I was like, hey, I don't want to do this. She was like, right, what do you want to do? And she was like, fantastic. I've been waiting 5 years for you to say this. And so that's how the book came about.
Now, you were a Greek Cypriot on one side, and your mother was English.
Yeah.
But you grew up essentially in your father's restaurant, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in London, but my dad, well, he came over from Cyprus. He's from the Tudos Mountains. So he came over, and my parents used to run a restaurant together. So straight after nursery school, my mum would collect me, and I'd sit in the kitchen and watch my dad. And that's where my love of cooking and eating began, really, watching him and just thinking, wow, this is like super high-powered energy going on there. And my Greek got really good in terms of swear words as a child.
I bet.
and that's where it all grew, really.
Well, you know, some of the photographs are rather amazing. I love this photograph where, obviously, this cat has snuck up to the table and the photographer just caught her jumping off.
Well, that's kind of, that personifies the Greek way of life, really. They love their animals and they always have their cats. And the cats don't get up the table whilst you're eating, but they're opportunists. They're like, I see my chance, we'll take it. So we had to include that. And the table also shows how full it was. Because that's the thing about Greek food. You don't just have one plate and eat it, you know, by yourself. You order plenty of plates, and it's all about the sharing. And that's what I really love about Greek cooking, how food can bring people together. I mean, you'd never see a lone diner in any Greek restaurant, whether it's in America, London, or abroad. Feel really bad for you, like, what's wrong? You know, you must come join us, be part of our family, sit down, eat. So that's what I wanted to do about this book. I wanted to create some recipes that people enjoy, or they kind of make their own, and yet they'll be able to cook them and share them with the people that and give so much pleasure.
Now, we forgot to mention along the way here somewhere, we got from your sitting in the kitchen watching your dad cooking and learning swear words to actually there being a book that you wrote reinterpreting Greek cuisine in a more modern way. But we sort of missed out the part that's really important, which is along the way there you became a rather good chef too.
Yeah, I did go to, my dad gave up his restaurant, and I was only young then, but then he had his own little butchery business and stuff, and worked for other people, and then I left school and did an apprenticeship for 5 years, learning front and back of house and going through different establishments, learning different cuisines. So yeah, I had a hard graft career, and then, yeah, worked in various places abroad and in London to where I am now. But we need about a few more hours if we're going to discuss that.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you say a few other places, you mentioned El Bulli.
So I did start there. Yeah, that was incredible.
Arzak.
Really incredible. Yeah, and Arzak, yeah.
Incredible
experiences. Yeah, that really opened my eyes. You know, I thought that anything was possible. I had, like, anything's possible attitude, but when I went there, it was like, wow, anything really is possible. And throw away rule books and just create like crazy. So it really opened my eyes to spending time there.
And the good news for our American listeners is that now you're cooking here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so then I received a random email one day. I thought it was one of my friends messing me around saying, oh, I'm looking for a Greek chef for a restaurant I'm going to open in California. And I'm like, yeah, right. And then I got to the bottom that was from a legitimate source. And I wrote back saying, well, thanks, but I'm not really interested in living in America. And if you're looking for someone that cooks traditional Greek, you're kind of barking up the wrong tree. But, you know, this is my number. Give me a call. And I don't often answer my mobile if I don't know who it is. But when the mobile phone rang and it said Beverly Hills, California, I thought, different, and answered. So we had a long conversation. I told this guy, you know, I do cook Greek, but how I cook is that I take all the flavors that people are familiar with Greek cuisine. I use all those ingredients, and yet, well, I redesign them. I put them into recipes in a different way. Like I might create a carrot keftera rather than a meat keftera, which is a Greek meatball.
Right.
But it will still contain the essence of the flavors like cinnamon and dill and all the different cheeses that people would associate with Greek cuisine, but in my own style. So I started to tell him about all that, and he's like, and I was thinking, he'd say, well, you know, that's not what I'm looking for. And then he said, I love the sound of that.
Wow.
Suddenly the tape was turned, and I was like, oh my, someone's really interested in what I've, you know, I'm doing. And that was before my book was about to be released in London. So he said, come see me. So I was consulting in New York at the time. I was due to go to New York, and so I thought, well, on the right continent, I'll fly over. And so that was about 7 months ago. And now we've opened a restaurant up. It's in a small boutique, 5-star resort, right on the shores of Lake Tahoe. It's called The Landing, and the restaurant is called Jimmy's, after the boss, Jim. And so it's Californian Greek, and we cook on a wood-fired grill and wood-fired oven. And we use amazing Californian produce with fat that we import from Greece. And it's really exciting, really, really exciting.
Well, we have to go there.
You must come. You must come visit.
I've never been to Lake Tahoe.
I got close. Oh, I got stunning. Close once. I was in Carson. I stayed in Carson City one time. I think it was like September or October, and it had already snowed, and there was no way to drive over the mountains to Lake Tahoe. So
we had
never
a freak snowstorm last month.
Yeah,
I nearly missed my flight.
Let's illustrate one of the things, or what you're talking about is. Is there one dish? I mean, I'm looking for a dish where you take the most traditional dish recipe and then you modify it and update it and make it your own. And I just happen to have the book open at Skordalia, and that might make a good example of how you do that.
Yeah, I guess
Or is there another dish you'd rather dissect, explaining to our listeners how you change things, how you go about this?
I'm really in love with my carrot keftera recipe.
Okay, that's good.
That's the first one. And also the baklava, the tomato and bean one.
The baklava with the rabbit?
And also the rabbit one, yeah, because they're not things that you would normally associate. You'd normally associate with being a sweet dish.
Yes, I was going to read that recipe really closely. We're sitting with two rabbits in the basement trying to do it.
They might not appreciate that.
No, they're in the freezer.
They're pet rabbits.
Dead rabbits.
They've been dead a good long time.
Oh. I don't know your pet rabbits.
No, we don't eat that. We don't even like, we were in Lima, we don't like eating cooey and the guinea pigs even. Anyhow, so take one of those recipes and just sort of walk us through how you've changed it.
So the carrot keftera one, I was actually in Cyprus. I went to Cyprus to cook with my dad before I wrote this book, and said, I'm going to hang out with you at your taverne. Okay. And I got asked by a London magazine to write a vegetarian recipe while I was out there. And I was thinking, I should keep to the Greek theme because, you know, I'm in Cyprus. And I thought long and hard about it. Well, I used to sleep on it. I woke up and was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take carrots as my subject and make them into a keftera, keftera being a meatball normally.
Right.
And I thought, well, meatballs have got loads of flavouring. They've got the grated onion and the fresh herbs. So I thought, I'm going to do that with carrots. So I thought, if I roasted the carrot long enough in the hole, then I'd bring out all its caramelization, and then I'd use that and upgrade that and mix it with all the things I would normally do with meatball and see what I got. And the result was, I was really happy with it. And so it's something that you would take familiar flavors like the dill and the mint and the parsley and the keftera and the feta, but instead you'll have carrots rather than meat. And then to that, I put that with a pomegranate scordalia. So scordalia being a garlic-based sauce either made with potato or bread. And then to that I just added pomegranate molasses. So it's not like rocket science, but it's all the flavours that my palate goes crazy for, kind of mixed up in my own way, really.
And beautiful.
I mean, Greeks think I've gone a bit crazy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. What do you
Yeah, he thinks I've gone out of my mind. He's so traditional. So when I was in Cyprus, I had a little apartment. I used to walk down the village street each day to the taverna and back. And I used to pass this amazing fig tree, you know, really lovely, ripe, juicy figs on it. And right next to it was an almond tree. So every day I'd pass this fig tree, its leaves really fragrant with its figs. And then I got the opportunity to do a little bit of cooking in my uncle's garden. He's got this, like, little wood-burning oven. And so I picked the fig leaves and wrapped some feta in it and then put them in nets and then put them in the oven just to kind of cook the feta down a little bit, soften the feta, and then the leaves gave off their fig scent. Took them out of the oven, opened the parcels up, tore the fresh figs in, and then added some fresh almonds that crept from the tree on top, a little bit of grape kind of syrup. And they ate it, and they were like, oh, my God, how do you think of this? How do you think of this? And then I looked at them and said, well, you see, everything is one-dimensional to them. You know, feta is something you put on top of Greek salad. But to me, it's more. And there's those figs that they would just eat after a meal. And there's the leaves. And right next to it is the almond tree. So automatically, those three things just there going, come on, use me. I'm like, I'm at the best I could possibly be. So that's kind of how I think. I look at what's around me and get inspired.
Well, it is inspirational, and you're very artful in all of this, too.
Well, talk to us about rabbit baklava.
Oh, yeah.
since as we said just a second ago, we have a couple of rabbits in the basement looking for something to happen to them.
I picked my pet rabbit. No, I'm joking. rabbit's one of my favourite meats, and I think people are always a little bit off about it. But if you confit, you cook it in duck fat. It's gorgeous. And so I combine rabbit with some white beans, which are really Greek, normally gigantes, cooked in tomato sauce. And I put them with lots of cooked down onions and thyme, a little bit of oregano, and then I layer that between with the rabbit and a little bit of feta and almonds for texture. And then I usually serve that with parsnip scordalia or braised chard salads. So that's just something. I often dream of what I'm going to cook.
Oh, wow. So you wake up and write it down?
Yeah. iPhones are quite good because now you can use your notes rather than stumble around in the dark for a bit of paper and pen, you know. Yeah. And then you wake up in the morning and go, oh, my God, what does that writing say? So that's why an iPhone is really good because I use my notes a lot on my phone.
I have to ask you about this. I don't know if Peter picked this up or not.
A little squeak?
Yeah, but do you know why?
No, I don't know why.
Think Cockney. What do you think Bubble and Squeak might be in Cockney?
Greek.
Yep.
Yeah. That's right, isn't it?
I know all about.
Because I used to have a flatmate. They used to always call me Bubble. Because he thought it was funny that I was Greek. So rather than Bubble and Squeak, he used to call me Bubble. And so it's kind of my little love to myself that I put Bubble and Squeak in there.
Well, that's the whole thing about Cockney rhyming slang. You don't use both words.
So that's why Bubble and Squeak's in there, because nod to him.
So you can get away with saying things like Friar and Hampton.
What's that one?
There we go.
Hampton Wick.
Oh, I don't know those.
Okay.
You're in the place, Hampton Wick. Far from where I grew up, actually.
Yeah, but that's not what, that's in Cockney rhyming slang, that's not what it means.
What does it mean?
It's a male organ, dear.
Oh!
That ends in I-C-K.
Oh, boy.
Fried Tuck is very clever because it's got the first letter and then the last three.
When did you learn this from?
You know he's English, you know that.
I lived in London for several years in the 1960s.
Now, one last thing here is you have a list of the pantry items for a Greek kitchen. And in that list, you include spirits that you use in cooking. Ouzo, I've used myself a lot, and Metaxa, of course, you'd use as cognac. But you have a section on Greek wine saying you love Greek wines.
Yes.
And, I mean, Greek wine used to be Retsina, and it's not Retsina anymore.
But, not anymore.
No, but I was telling you that I've had, it was a ringer in a blind tasting. It was a Greek wine that was just wonderful. And yet I've also had samples from modern wines of Greece that were just awful. Are there any guidelines as to how you get decent wines, modern wines and Greek wines?
Well, I mean, the whole wine industry has changed now. They've got much more modern. There's some young guns that have gone in there and gone, hey, this is the modern way to produce wine. Look what you could do. There's no reason why wine shouldn't be great from Greece, thinking about its viticulture and its climate and the great varieties that they've got. So I would probably, to be on the safe side, I'd probably go to maybe a wine from Santorini, because Santorini often produces wine a bit more in a chubby style.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, there's a Certico or a Diac. They're called Diac. And it's a kind of traditional red.
Uh-huh.
Or you can get some wild ferment one. Or, yeah, no, you'd be safe if you went with a Diac. Certico grape.
No, I remember we had some excellent Greek wines at a Greek restaurant in New York called Molivos.
Oh, that's probably great.
And I'm guessing that another way of going about it would be to go to your restaurant in
Tel Aviv. Tremendous Greek wines, yeah.
And sample the Greek wines you have there and then figure out where you can buy them for your consumption at home. I mean, I think that's a smart way to go, because somebody in your employ has already done all the work of figuring out whether it's any good or not.
Yeah, that's the fun bit, isn't it, tasting it.
Well, it is indeed. We do not have any Greek wine in the house tonight. Otherwise, I would certainly serve it with dinner.
Yeah, but you know what? We're going to fava beans are in season. We just had those last night.
Yes,
and
right.
I should have done this recipe, which is lemon and dill braised artichokes and fava beans. So that sounds
great.
Well, I don't have any of those ingredients, so we had fava beans last night.
Yeah, but we'll get
not with Chianti though.
Uh-huh. And I want to say one more thing is that people who have a sweet tooth will not be disappointed, because you have that wonderful sweet tooth that the Greek cuisine features so expertly. I mean, really sweet. And you have wonderful recipes in here, mouth-watering.
Thank you so much.
Yes. And let's have this chocolate orange and anise tart. Oh, well. Maria, it's been great talking to you. And, again, it's Smashing Plates, which is a great title for this book, Redefining Greek Flavors Redefined by Maria Elia. And it's wonderful talking to you again.
Lovely to talk to you, too. Thank you so much for having me back home.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because right after the break, we're going to give you the secret as to how to cook America's least favorite ingredient, okra.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
You never would have guessed, would you, that there was a book in okra, a book about okra.
Well, you know, I happen to love okra.
There you go, but a lot of people don't. But with the help of
Virginia Willis has written a little book with a great big impact, because if you think you didn't like okra and you try some of these recipes, you're going to change your mind.
You'll be converted, as they might say.
We're pleased to be talking to Virginia Willis, a chef and food writer from Atlanta, a true Southerner. And I think we talked to you last time when it was, what, Basic to Brilliant, y'all?
Is that yes,
it?
Ma'am. That was a previous book, one of my 10-speed y'all press books. But this time I'm here with you to talk about okra.
Right. And this book series is one I said to you before we came on air of Savor of the South cookbook series is a winner. If anybody wants to see all the subjects, they should certainly go online. And it's put out by the University of North Carolina Press, right?
Yes, yes. Put out by the, and it's wonderful. There's a great series of ingredients that are featured in the South, certainly not exclusively Southern, but are inherent to Southern cooking and Southern cuisine. Buttermilk, pecans, tomatoes. I think there's one on sweet potatoes. One just recently came out on pickles and preserves.
Right. And we have that one, too.
Really fantastic. Just highly intense, about 50 recipes, yeah, all about that subject. So it's beautiful. It's a really nice exploration of the subject.
Let's be fundamentally honest here and say that there are, yep, there are two groups of people with opinions about okra.
You are correct.
Those who love it and those who think it's the most despicable plant that's ever been grown.
No, I know. It's very true. And part of it's possibly my nature, but I love okra. I grew up loving okra. I haven't met an okra that I don't like. I like it when it's so cooked to softness that you don't even hardly have to swallow. I like it fried. I like it with tomatoes, all sorts of ways. But I am very aware that it's a contentious vegetable. So I sort of wanted the challenge, and I've included 10 slime-busting tips.
Yeah, I thought that was cute, yeah.
And there are ways, some people that are never going to be converted, but I like to refer to myself as an okra missionary. I'm trying to preach to the unconverted.
Well, I mean, I've always liked okra pickles, but I really think that I fell in love with them when Peter started putting them on the grill.
Yes. The key is okra as a vegetable has a property that, you know, technically it's called mucilage, which,
right,
sounds like a condition, frankly, but really that's the slimy part. That's the part that people don't like. But the seeds inside, the slimy part is what helps the seed when it falls on the earth and it's trying to grow into a plant. It gives it moisture. So it's just part of the nature of the beast. But one way to lessen or not emphasize is to cook it quickly over high heat. And grilling is a perfect technique for cooking okra.
Now, you know, reading your book, it occurred to me, I have never, ever, ever seen an okra plant grow. I mean, I've never seen one.
Oh, and they're beautiful.
That's what you said.
So okra, it's a member of the hibiscus family. So if you think about that beautiful hibiscus flower with the almost like paper mache petals and the bright yellow pistil coming out of the center, that's what okra looks like. So it's a beautiful flower.
And it's tall.
And they're tall. They grow quite tall. Most okra plants, I get so excited. Most okra plants are about 6 feet tall, but they can get 8, 9 feet tall. They're these towering plants that really, they love the heat and they love the moisture. It's a subtropical plant. It's meant to be in like almost jungle-like conditions.
Well, let's go back to its origin in just a second, because that in and of itself is a fascinating story.
Yes.
But Anne was telling me, she read a little more of the book than I had, and she said that perhaps you got enthusiastic about okra on one occasion when you bought a bushel of it.
Oh, yes.
I love this story.
Once we had to buy it. Are you speaking at the time in France?
Yeah, with Ann Willard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was almost 20 years ago in France, and or 15 rather, years ago in France, and we were testing recipes at La Varenne for Ann Willard. And okra was truly an exotic vegetable in France.
I think it must still be. I can't imagine ever seeing it.
It would have only been in the African markets. I mean,
right,
in the African and the different ethnic markets. But we had to order a case, a bushel essentially, of okra from Rangis, you know, the farmer's market,
right,
of France, to test this one okra recipe for gumbo. And sadly, the gumbo wasn't up to snuff, and Anne decided that it didn't need to continue with testing, and we needed to cut our losses on that one. And as the test kitchen person, I was faced with a bushel minus 2 cups of okra to manage and to deal with. And one of the things that I did, because I grew up eating it, was I fried okra, and of course there was no cornmeal, so I pulped some polenta in the food processor, and we made fried okra, and Anne called it okra popcorn. popcorn. And I do dare say fried okra being sipped with sparkling wine at a chateau in Burgundy. I can dare say that was probably the only time that's ever happened.
I think it was really interesting.
I'm sure it has. But the
sounds like it would have been good, too.
But the story of the plant itself and the way that it has spread around the world,
right,
he's like a social history, isn't it?
It really is fascinating. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to do this book is because I have so much respect for the university press. I'm very proud of my books with Random House, and I'm proud of what I do on that. But I was a former history major, and I really admire the real work that the university presses, like University of North Carolina Press, do with the sort of the scholarly vision of food and cooking and cookbook. So I did a lot of research for this book as well. I mean, I know a lot of Southern recipes, but there's 25 Southern recipes, and then there are 25 global recipes.
Yeah, which I thought were amazing.
Thank you. And I also did some work about its origin. So essentially, okra, like many Southern ingredients, okra came from Western Africa.
Yeah, Peter said that it looked to him like it followed the slave trade.
Well, in fact,
exactly.
In fact, I think
essentially,
you said
where there has been slavery, there has been okra.
You say that in your book, I think.
Yes, and where essentially there have been Africans, there has been okra. So it came to the South, then also it's throughout the Caribbean, into South America and the northern parts of South America and Brazil. But you'll also notice that there's a piece of it that's a result of the slave trade, but because of its tropical nature, it's found all throughout the world, not just where the slave trade was, but it's found all throughout the world in that
Asia.
Climate.
You said
right.
Asia.
Right.
Yeah.
In Asia.
You said the Portuguese had a word for it.
I don't think you're going to trust me with my Southern accent to try that. I don't know that we need that. But basically, there's a lot of different words that quimbo, Q-U-I-M-B-O, gumbo. That's where that word came from. Like the word gumbo that we associate as a stew-like dish is a derivative of the Portuguese, perhaps a derivative of the Portuguese word for okra.
And they went everywhere, of course, the Portuguese.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's really, you've never seen the plant, but if you can just imagine that pod drying, first of all, they'll dry on the plant, and when they dry enough, fascinating piece of Mother Nature, that the pods will explode and the seeds scatter, and it's just beautiful. But the pods themselves will, if you pull them off the plant, they dry, and they can be used for decorative purposes. I mean, they can really be pretty as sort of a botanical accent.
Yeah, you say they come in all these different colors and everything too.
Well, they do when it's ripe. Everything pretty much cooks green, a shade of green. But okra, there are different varieties of okra that are almost just like pale yellow green, all the way to something like a hill country red, which is deep red burgundy okra. It's a beautiful plant.
Picture it, if you can, listeners, as it's a perfect foil for a spicy sauce or a spicy stew of some kind. And that seems to be the common thread that runs through okra as it goes all the way from India in the east to the West Indies in the west. And,
right,
of course, the American South, too. There, I guess in the American South, the recipes tend to be less spicy. In Cuba, in Jamaica,
yes,
and other parts of the Caribbean, on the islands there, they seem to be spicier.
Well, and one thing I think that I was so pleased and pleasantly surprised to learn was that there are two very popular ways to prepare okra in the South, in the Deep South, not Louisiana, but in the Deep South, traditionally okra is fried or okra is cooked with tomatoes. Okra and tomatoes is a very classic dish. And I learned through the research and recipe development for this book that every culture that grows okra, Greece, Egypt, India, Brazil, that every culture that grows okra has some form of fried okra in its cuisine and some form of okra and tomatoes in its cuisine. Not exactly like the Southern version. India, for example, contains cumin and coriander and turmeric and garlic and ginger in their okra and tomatoes. But nonetheless, both of those techniques, the frying technique minimizes the sliminess, and then the acid in the tomatoes, once again, also minimizes the sliminess. So those are two techniques that are pretty much found throughout the world on cooking okra.
The only thing I wish during the summertime when I see okra at $4.99 a pound or $5.99 a pound is that I don't live further south so that I can get it at a reasonable price.
Well, I tell you, so I spend my summers in Massachusetts quite often, and a I guess it was 3 years ago, I was at the farmer's market in Amherst, Massachusetts, and there was a farmer there who had this, it was like a half-pint blueberry box of okra pod, and it was a dollar a pod, and I paid a dollar a pod for this okra because I was kind of homesick, and it was just so beautiful and freshly harvested, and it was the perfect size. And I have to tell you, Peter, I don't know who was more surprised, the farmer that sold okra in Amherst, Massachusetts for a dollar a pod, or me, the person who spent, the southern girl that spent a dollar a pod on okra.
No. Well, I tell you what, that sounds like a good place to end this conversation, because along with the first pound of okra you buy, you're going to have to buy this book, which is how much?
I don't know.
Oh, dear.
Willis, and it's okra, and it's whatever it is, it's money well spent, because you'll never have a more creative approach to this universal, I'd say, almost universal vegetable or fruit.
And you'll never meet an okra that you don't love.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you so much for having me on, and people can access the UNC Press site to purchase the book through my website, which is virginiawillis.com.
Good to talk to you again, Virginia.
Thank you so much. I'll have a great day.
So we started out with Brooklyn Brewery beer. We've gone via Chicago. We've gone via Lake Tahoe. We've gone via London. We finished up with okra. My goodness, what a week's program. We hope you enjoyed it, and you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.